Well, good morning. Today we're actually going to be talking about God's faithfulness, and sometimes God's faithfulness slaps you upside the head in a way that you didn't see coming. So, in the book of Acts, we are at one of those great turning points as Paul's going to bring one story to, Luke's going to bring one story to a conclusion, and he's going to start another one. So far, what we've been looking at is Luke's portrayal of the early church. Sometimes he's talking about the Hebrews, sometimes he's talking about the Hellenists, but kind of in and around Jerusalem and then out from there various places. Today we're going to turn to Luke's great hero, because the book of Acts is really fundamentally the story of Paul. And it's that to which Luke has been leaning. And really, for the rest of Acts, we're really going to be talking about Paul. Because if you know the structure of Acts, it's basically the story of when God calls Paul a little bit before, and then all Paul's ministry, and then Paul's going to wind up in Rome, which is one of the ancient ends of the world for a Jew, and ending there as the gospel has finally arrived at the center of the Roman Empire. We're going to begin where Luke begins. Why is Paul on the road to Damascus? Very famous story. What's the burr under his saddle, as my grandfather would say? He's really motivated to be nasty. He will admit that. By his own admission, he was attempting to eradicate the Christian faith with threats and murder. Now, how about that for a lineage, you know? And his conversion is probably one of the most unlikely ones of all time. So we start back in Acts 9. Meanwhile, Saul, still breathing threats and murder, so Luke is referencing something here he's already told us, that he introduced Paul a little bit earlier, against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters. So Paul takes the initiative. He goes to the high priest in the temple. He requests to be given permission to go to the synagogues of Damascus, so that if he found any who belonged to the way, that's the earliest name of our faith, as far as we know. Remember Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so early Christians identified with that and thought of themselves as the way, meaning the way of Jesus. Men or women, that he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. And guess what he would like to have done with them? Do you remember a guy named Stephen? So that's the imagery here. Paul would like to eradicate this cancer. Now, this is not hyperbole. Earlier, Luke introduced us to Saul and the story of Stephen, so we're going to jump back just for a second. And Luke told us that those who stoned Stephen put their coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. Now, that is a loaded image because it might mean a couple of different things. It raises questions. What is Saul's role in the death of Stephen? Is he simply a bystander? Or as many scholars think, more likely, he's the guy in charge. Why would you have somebody take care of all your coats? And why is somebody not getting their hands dirty but getting other people to do it for them? That very well could be, and there's some other things that leads that direction. Then Luke adds this chilling note, Paul approved of the killing of Stephen. So if he's not in charge, at least he's the amen corner over there. He thoroughly approves of this act, the first martyrdom. So we now find in the passage today that Paul has moved from the sidelines to being an active participant in the persecution. Likely he is the key leader of the movement. He's the guy that goes to the high priest, which says a lot. Not everybody has access to the high priest. And he requests to be given permission to go to Damascus and to eradicate the cancer up there. So here's the first question we want to deal with. Why is he so upset about this new movement? And there are lots of reasons that scholars think could fit into that, that might explain his hostility. One was the way that Jesus died, because there is this statement in Deuteronomy that says this, anyone hung on a tree is under God's curse. Scholars say that's a reference to the crucifixion. Crucifixion is pre-Roman. It goes all the way back to the Assyrians as a form of death. It is a form of death designed to be excruciating, and it's reserved for the most heinous people that you really want to send a message to. So the theology here says that if you are crucified, you're under God's curse. Was Jesus crucified? Okay, so now we've got a movement that began with a person and a message of a man who's been cursed by God. Does that predispose you as an Orthodox Jew to like this movement? If you think that the crucifixion itself is witness, is testimony, is evidence that this guy was under God's curse. In other words, that this guy had committed blasphemy. So that's a possibility. It could have also been the movement's earlier attack on the temple. We know that Jews, Second Temple Judaism, they're hypersensitive about the temple and Moses, of course, but they're really protective of the temple. Do you remember Stephen's speech? God's not in the temple, and the temple is an idol. Okay? Well, you'd be a little sensitized if there's a movement that's saying that kind of thing. Or there was that statement by Jesus, you know, I will destroy this temple in 3 days, rebuild it. And that could be interpreted as, well, Jesus was attacking the temple, although there's no reason to believe he actually did attack the temple. The most likely reason, though, is the one that Paul himself gives us in his letters. It is this code word, zeal, for his faith. So we want to kind of look at that. But in Galatians, this is what Paul tells us. You have heard, no doubt, of my earlier life in Judaism. I was violently persecuting the church of God. This is not Luke about Paul. This is autobiographical. This is Paul. He acknowledges this. I was trying to destroy it. I advanced in Judaism beyond many among my people of my same age, for I was more zealous. Just flag that. To be zealous is to say something profound. To say that you're more zealous than your contemporaries is to put a huge statement out there, and Paul is comfortable putting it out there. Zealous for the traditions of my ancestors. In Philippians, he says this, I was circumcised in the eighth day, a member of the people of Israel, a tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew, a born of the Hebrews. So very proud of his Jewish heritage. As to the law, I was a Pharisee. That's the strict sect. As to zeal, there's that code word again, a persecutor of the church. It is Paul that is linking the persecution to this term zeal that we want to look at. And he makes this direct connection. Zeal for the traditions of the Jewish faith for Israel. Now, Luke concurs because later in Acts chapter 22, this is Luke's writing, here's what we have. Paul says, I'm a Jew, born in Tarsus in Cilicia, brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, the greatest Jewish rabbi of the age, educated strictly according to our ancestral law, being zealous for God. Now, this term zeal is central to understanding Paul at the stoning of Stephen and Paul on the road to Damascus prior to the conversion. And so we just want to do a little backstory as to why this is. It turns out that there's a direct connection between zeal and murder. And remember, Paul himself made that connection, but it's not unique to him. There's a long tradition that goes back here. This term goes back to a story that I was never taught in Sunday school. I can see why. Never taught in seminary. Again, I can probably see why. Never heard a sermon on it. I can probably see why, too. It goes back to the book of Numbers, and it's the story of Phinehas. Y'all ever heard the story of Phinehas? It's not one of the top 10 Bible verses, just so you know, okay? Yeah. Here it is, Numbers 25. This is back in the time of Joshua and Aaron and that. Just as one of the Israelites came and brought a Midianite woman into his family in the sight of Moses, you know, the law, and in the sight of the whole congregation of Israelites, we're bringing a foreign woman in, then Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, this is Aaron's grandson, saw it. He got up, he left the congregation, taking a spear in his hand, he went after the Israelite man into the tent. He pierced the two of them, the Israelite and the woman, through the belly. Now, the inference here is he caught them in the act of having sex, and he gets a two for one, kills them both in the act of sex. So the plague was stopped among the people of Israel. We don't know. I'd have to go back dig that story. There's a plague and... Don't overthink it. Deuteronomic theology, remember that? If you obey the Lord your God, things go well. If you disobey the Lord your God, things do not go well. We got a plague, which means what? Something's not right, you know. And he brought a foreign woman. You know them foreign women, don't you? Yeah. And it went away. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, Phinehas has turned back my wrath from the Israelites by manifesting what?
Zeal
among them on my behalf. Now, by the first century, this act has become a paradigm. Matter of fact, it's interesting. If you Google Phinehas, what you're really going to get is a large number of Jewish rock bands. I'm not making that up, you know. Just because the idea of zeal for the Lord is still really, really big within Jewish tradition. It becomes a powerful symbol for being faithful to God. It is a model to be copied. Even the stabbing part is a model to be copied. So let's see how this plays out. You remember the Maccabean revolt? This is 160s BC. The Greeks have taken over. One of the Greek kings is trying to eradicate the Jewish faith, makes circumcision illegal, makes owning a Torah illegal, makes all that illegal. And so Matthias and his family of sons, they have left Jerusalem. They've gone out to Modin so they can be careful. And then Matthias saw that a Jew came forward because the evil Greeks have now come to the little town of Modin where he's trying to get away from all this. And so Matthias saw a Jew come forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar in Modin. Not sacrifice to Yahweh, sacrifice to the Greek god. Okay. He burned, there's the code word, with zeal. And his heart was stirred. Well, what do you do when you have zeal? He gave vent to righteous anger. He ran and killed the man at the altar. At the same time, he killed the king's officer who was forcing the sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. You're beginning to get a feel for zeal? Okay. It continues. Thus he burned with zeal for the law, just as Phinehas did against Zimri, son of Salu. Direct connection here. Philo of Alexandria, 1st century AD, contemporary with Paul, writes this. If any members of the nation, the Jewish nation, he's a Jew, betray the honor due to God, they should suffer the utmost penalties. And it is well that they that all who have zeal for virtue should be permitted to exact penalties offhand and without delay, without bringing the offender before jury or council or any kind of magistrate at all, to give full scope to the feelings which possess them, the hatred of evil and love of God, which urges them to inflict punishment without mercy upon the impious. There is in the history of the law a record of one man, Phinehas. There he is again. Who ventured in his exploit of noble daring. It's now become a noble act. For when he saw some men connecting themselves with foreign women, neglecting, now it's become a group of people, not just one, neglecting all their national customs and laws, he was seized with a sudden zeal in the presence of the whole multitude. He slew one man together with the woman who was with him. Sirach, in the Catholic Bible, not ours, from the same time period. Phinehas, son of Eleazar, ranks third in glory, only behind Abraham and Moses. Well, why did he get that promotion? Okay, here it goes. For being zealous in the fear of the Lord, standing firm when the people turned away, and the noble courage of his soul, this just gets really funny, he made atonement for Israel. He atoned for this. How did he do that? Well, you know how he did that. Psalm 106. When Phinehas stood up and interceded, and that has been reckoned to him as righteousness from generation to generation. Remember what Paul says? Abraham had faith. And that was recognized as righteousness. Here's an alternative standing. What Phinehas did, you know, to kill the offender because of your zeal for the Lord. That is how you're reckoned to be righteous. Do you get a feel? Okay. This is the background. Lois? Yeah, a couple of problems. The commandment's not thou shalt not, well, it does say murder, but it really applies only in the community. Foreigner. Or if you offend. Now, it says did not kill, but then, you know, in the Old Testament, how many exceptions are there? Quite a few, yeah. You got a general principle, we should not murder other Israelites, which means to kill unlawfully. This is a lawful killing. This ain't murder, because it's zeal for the Lord. That gets you a bye. Yes?
I think it's an interesting circle that Moses' wife was a Midianite.
Yeah, among others. Ruth the Moabitess. You go down the genealogy of Jesus, you know, we have five women that are crucial to David being born. All five women are Gentiles. Yeah. It's a big tent faith. There's a lot in there. So, it's not always consistent. So what they have in common is the exalting of zeal in the Lord to maintain the customs and boundaries and to keep Israel safe, resulting in a license to kill anyone who threatens those boundaries. That's Paul. Paul just said, I am more zealous than any of my contemporaries. Now do you get a psych profile in Paul? Okay, this is who he is. He's passionate of his faith. He's of this tradition that associates anything that threatens our faith, the zeal in my heart for God, it's okay to act out and kill. Does that fit the empirical evidence of Acts and Paul? Does exactly. So this is Paul's ethos he's kind of working with, you know. This is what's behind the stoning of Stephen. This is the reason he's on the road to Damascus. So the story opens, Paul's on the road to Damascus, breathing threats of murder. Paul and the temple leaders tried to stop the movement in one synagogue in Jerusalem with the stoning of Stephen, and pretty much it worked. Remember? Acts says they scattered to the four winds. Well, took care of that one. Now the cancer is spread, it's in Damascus, and what do you need to do if you're zealous for the Lord? Eradicate it. There's Paul. As the story begins, by his own admission, trying to destroy the Jesus movement. This is the backstory that now narrates. With that background, we now have, of course, we know the story, but if you're reading Acts for the first time, this would be quite a surprise. Now, as he was going along, approaching Damascus, so he's near Damascus, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And he asked, who are you, Lord? He knows it's something divine. He doesn't know. The answer came, I'm Jesus, whom you're persecuting. I'm sure that's not what he wanted to hear. But get up, enter the city, and you will be told what you are to do. The men who were traveling with him stood speechless because they heard the voice, but saw no one. Not sure what voice is being referenced here. Saul got up from the ground, and though his eyes were open, he could see nothing. He's blinded. And they led him by the hand and brought him into the city of Damascus. For 3 days he was without sight and neither ate nor drank. So fairly significant event in Paul's life. You know, blind and can't eat or drink for 3 days. Okay, the location of the event. Paul says several times in his letters that he saw the Lord, but he never actually says where it happens. But in Galatians, he actually drops a clue that says Luke probably has this right. It's in the Damascus area, because this is what he says in Galatians 1. When God was pleased to reveal his son to me, I went away at once into Arabia, and afterwards I returned to Damascus. So if you're returning to Damascus, where were you before? Likely in the Damascus area. So Paul kind of concurs with what Luke is saying. Now the question is, what in the heck happened? Multiple possibilities. Was it a vision? Is it something other people would have seen and heard? Or is it something private to Paul? And here's the interesting thing. Luke tells the story three times with three different versions. So you pays your quarter, you takes your choice. We've got choices here. So let's look at what's going on. Or is it an internal vision, when only Paul would have experienced? Paul sees a light. He hears a voice. He has a dialogue with Jesus. The men with Paul hear the voice but saw no one. Makes it sound maybe like a vision, although they're hearing, but they're not seeing. Luke tells the story three times in Acts, different accounts. So let's just kind of look through them real quick. Acts 9, we have this. The men who were traveling with him stood speechless because they heard the voice, saw no one. So Acts 9, they hear, they don't see. Acts 22, now those who were with me saw the light, did not hear the voice. Opposite, okay. Acts 26, I saw the light, I heard the voice, which makes it sound like what? Like a visionary experience, okay. Luke's three accounts, it becomes clear that Luke's understanding is that he did have a vision, because Luke will say in Acts 26, Paul says, I was not disobedient to what? The heavenly vision. So, and in Paul's writings, it's pretty clear he thinks in terms of visionary language. Now, the difference in the accounts we shouldn't get too bothered by, because in the ancient world, this was something called performance art. When you tell a story, and you tell the story again, is it always exactly the same? Or does the fish grow? That's true in the ancient world, and a lot of ancient authors knew this. So this is called performance art. Nobody had an expectation, that's not the core of the story. But despite the differences, the core of the story is exactly the same in all three accounts, with some variation. They contain two core elements. First of all, Jesus encounters the risen Jesus, and Paul encounters the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus. All three true? Bing, bing, bing. Yeah, it is. And second is that Paul is given a commission to take the gospel to the Gentiles. True all three times. By the way, Paul confirms both of these things. In Galatians, he says this, God was pleased to reveal his son to me so that I might proclaim him among the Gentiles. So don't get lost in the shrubbery. The heart of it is exactly the same. God calls this enemy of the faith and calls him to be an apostle to the Gentiles. This becomes the defining moment in his life, one of the most dramatic about faces in history. Maybe not as about faces we would first think. This experience transforms Paul from persecutor to advocate. But guess what? Paul is still Paul. And he is just as zealous. But his zeal has got a new direction. So he's changed, but he's not changed. You know, after the Damascus Road, he's just as zealous. The zeal's got a new focus. It's got a new direction. And we're going to see this in Acts. We're going to see this in Paul's letters. He's now committed, ironically, the very thing he was called to stop, he's now called to promote. How about that for an about face? Yeah. I would think that he had spent the next 3 days just dealing with the whiplash of that. One outstanding issue. Is it appropriate to speak of the Damascus Road experience as we do in terms of conversion? Because when you read this story, have you heard the term Paul's conversion experience or conversion story? That's one of those, it's all in the definitions. How do you find conversion? So let's look at this. Here's the blunt version. Did Paul go up to Damascus a Jew and come back a Christian? Did Paul go up to Damascus a Jew and come back a non-Jew and something different? That's the way that's normally interpreted very often. The way that we use the term conversion today, we'd have to answer that no, because Paul's very clear of that. Luke's very clear of that. Luke and Paul make it absolutely clear that no point in Paul's life did he ever cease being Jewish. Or did he think of himself as anything other than a Torah observant Jew for Jesus, which is the part that God added. In Acts, when Paul is arrested in Jerusalem at the end of his ministry, he twice addresses the Jewish crowd. This is what he has to say. In Acts 21:39, we have this. Paul replied, I am a Jew from Tarsus of Cilicia. This is the end of his life. Has he given up his Jewish identity? He has not. Acts chapter 22, I am a Jew born in Tarsus. Again, same thing again. Paul confirms this in his letter. Galatians is the gold standard we go back to, because chapter 2 of Galatians is just a gold mine. We ourselves are Jews. So the Jewish identity is simply not going away. 2 Corinthians, are they Hebrews? Well, so am I. Are they Israelites? Well, guess what? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Does Paul think of himself as a Jew? Okay. Whatever following Jesus means, whatever happened on the road to Damascus, it does not mean he ceased being a Torah observant and very passionate Jew. It's interesting, this last one, these words are written 25 years after the road to Damascus, and he's still thinking, no, I'm still a Jew. That is not what happened on the road to Damascus. However we understand it, whatever happened there, Paul does not cease thinking of himself in terms of being Jews, but it's Paul who gives us the key to understand. Paul gives us some language that we can understand what he thought happened on the road to Damascus. And again, what's the gold standard letter here? Galatians, chapters 1 and 2, absolutely priceless. But when God, who had set me apart before I was born. Now, does that language sound vaguely familiar? Where have you heard about God setting somebody apart? You read the prophets lately? Jeremiah, Isaiah. This is prophetic speak. God calls you, sets you apart to do something. He called me through his grace, set me apart, called me. This is not conversion language. This is prophetic call language. God is calling Paul just like he called Jeremiah or Isaiah or any of the ancient prophets. God calls a prophet and gives them a particular task to carry out. And Paul understands that's what's happening to his life. Not the language of conversion, it is the language of prophetic call. So in Isaiah we have this, from my mother's womb he called my name. Behold, I've set you as a covenant to my people. Jeremiah, same thing. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated or set you apart. So it appears that Paul's self-understanding, as he stands in this tradition, the Jews, after the exile, believed that prophecy had come to an end. And then after 400 years of silence, this weird guy out in the desert appeared. Who was that? John the Baptist. Prophet. Jesus. Understood as prophet, and now the third prophet of the first century has emerged. John the Baptist, Jesus, Paul, all clearly stand in the line of prophets. Paul's not moving from one religion to other. He is moving from one Jewish sect to the other. He's moving from Pharisaic Judaism to Jesus Judaism. And that's probably true of anybody in the first century, you know. God called him and set him aside, just like the prophets old, to be the apostle to the Gentiles. This is language that Paul will use over and over again in his letters. Now, there is one sense in which it is a legitimate conversion. Was he the same guy going back that he was going up? Yeah. That's a conversion. It's not a conversion from one religion to another, but it is a conversion from one ideology to another. It's a complete turnaround for him. He's converted not from Judaism, but from Israel's set-apartness. All those boundaries that he was so passionate about, that all this zeal language is about. We've got these wonderful boundaries that give us identity, that give us safety. Anybody threatens those boundaries, we're justified to murder them, because it's no longer murder, illegitimate. He's converted from trying to stop the inclusion of Gentiles to a radical commitment to include them. That has to rank as one of the most profound turnarounds in history. I can't imagine a sharper kind of turnaround than that. His zeal to exclude is transformed in a zeal to include. And when we get to places like Antioch and Assyria and the story of Barnabas and Peter and all those stories we look at, I mean, he's still passionate. He's not a different person in the sense of his personality. He would still be a difficult person to deal with. Okay, you wouldn't want your daughter to marry him, probably. You know. Okay. He's converted to the very thing he'd been trying to destroy. And this vision of radical inclusion is what's going to drive him for the next 30 years. So what happens next in Acts is interesting, because Acts skips 17 years. Paul goes away. And then 17 years later, Luke's going to pick up the story. But we know from Paul's letters and some other sources what happened in those, quote, lost years of Paul. So next time we will do that. Meanwhile, would you like to kick this around a little bit? Thoughts, questions, observations? Yes, Gib.
When he was taken to Damascus, the guy he's supposed to see, who was the guy who went to his house?
I know, but I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't that guy, did he baptize him again? Did the Holy Spirit come on him?
Yes. Yes. And he spent a period of time there being instructed in the faith. So it's when he's converted, then he's taken into this home, can't see, can't speak for 3 days. And then he spends some time there, and he actually appears to be instructed in the faith, and then he's going to go to the desert kind of thing. Yeah. Which means that Paul learns about his faith, Christian faith, not in Jerusalem, not from the Hebrews, but from what? A Hellenist. Because it's the Hellenists. Right. And remember, the Hellenists are the ones who are much more inclusive, much more embracing, and more critical of the temple. And it appears that Paul's conversion takes place in that kind of a context, which is then going to make sense of some other stuff that goes on. Yeah, Tom. Right. Because Paul will say we are freed from the curse of the law. Yeah. Now, this gets complicated because we tend to read Paul through Luther. And the whole idea that faith and works are separate, that it's all about faith and works are negative, that's Luther's reading of Paul. And we now know from the Dead Sea Scrolls that is not Paul's understanding, because Paul, if you think about it, all of his letters, the first half are theology and the second half are practice. And Paul understands faith to include the life you live. So the word that we would use probably today is faithfulness or obedience. And there is no distinction between faith and works with faithfulness. And that's why some new Bibles are now retranslating that you're justified by faith. It's now been retranslated to you're justified by Christ's faithfulness. Yeah.
One final comment that I would say, that is, it seems to me that when you look at Romans, Paul is toward the end of that book trying to reconcile how Jews who stand in the old tradition and Jews who accept righteousness by faith can ultimately be reconciled to each other.
Right.
In the long run of history. So he's still struggling.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
That.
Chapters 11, 11, 12, and 13, where Paul asked the question twice, given that Jesus has come, does this mean that God has forsaken his own people Israel? And Paul answers twice, by no means. Paul's vision seems to be that God's people are Israel, and Israel is made up of the Jews through the covenant of Abraham and Moses, and Christians through the covenant of Jesus. I know that's a contemporary reading of that, but it's real dense and stuff. Yes?
Okay, Saul's using capital punishment against the Christians, if I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, after his conversion, probably because of the power structure, he wasn't going for, let's say, if somebody got to interfere with the Christians, he were executing them or...
No evidence of that. What Paul's real clear about is from this point on, he's on the receiving end. He was stoned once and left for dead. He, three times he got the 39 lashes. He was beaten by rods. My body bears the marks of Christ, just like Christ did. So Paul's language seems to be, he goes from being persecutor to being persecuted. And again, some of that may be the power structure, because who enforces these punishments? Well, rods is done by the Roman authorities. 39 lashes is done by a synagogue. So it appears that he was an equal opportunity offender. Yeah. Offends the Romans, gets punished, offends the Jews. But yeah, no evidence that Paul even thinks about or advocates the persecution part that we would do it goes away. I don't think his passion goes away, but the zeal language goes away. Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of thinking, to, you know, we need to purify the ranks. And so this and some other Old Testament scriptures are used for all kinds of horrendous crimes. Yes. Yes, according to Acts, and according, we knew in his letters at the end of his ministry, he collected the offering from his churches to take to Jerusalem to give it to the temple, hoping it'd be accepted. And Acts ends with Paul's last act, going to the temple, and he's then betrayed by other Christian believers, and then he gets arrested in the process of that. Well, I think, yeah. The book of Hebrews will argue that, because Christ is our high priest who made once and forever the sacrifice. The real kicker seems to be that this is all in the 40s and 50s. In 70, when the temple's destroyed, that's off the table. It's not even an option anymore. So now we're looking at a temple-less Judaism and a temple-less form of Christianity. But as long as the temple is there, it appears that Christians, the Hebrews, just camp at the temple. That's what we've been talking about. They just live there. Paul, even at the end of his ministry, after being a Jesus believer for 25, 30 years, his last act in his letters and Acts is, I want to get to the temple to take this offering of the Gentiles and present it to the temple so that the scriptures might be fulfilled, that God accepts the offering of the non-Jew and therefore accepts the non-Jew. Yes. Right. Here's the big, within Scripture, there are multiple trajectories. One is the Ezekiel, Ezra, Nehemiah, let's circle the wagons, let's stay pure, let's get the impurities out. And then there's the Isaiah, Zephaniah, no, we're called to be a light to the nations, we're called to embrace. Both those are Jewish. Both are found in Scripture. But I would argue that Jesus identified with one of those and not the other. And Paul also identified one of those, not the other. The sad thing is this is not just mullahs and Jews. If you look at Christian history, many occasions we have gone back to the other direction and tried, particularly after the Reformation, but even before that and the Middle Ages, that which we find dangerous, we will suppress. Maybe torture until you confess and then kill you so that we've eliminated that. And that, as a bishop told me right after seminary, we had to, Barbara and I, seminar, we got out of the seminary without ever taking a Methodism course, really embarrassing. We had to come back, and the one thing I remembered about the bishop, he said, I don't remember other thing, he said, this is what he said, if you're going to work in the church, you better have a really good doctrine of sin because you're going to see a lot of it. Human nature 101. Jewish, Muslim, Christian, so that prophetic call back to God's vision comes again and again. Luther called for it, and then Luther turned right around and persecuted. So, it's bothersome. It really is bothersome. Yes.
Well,
Right.
Not his genealogical heritage.
Correct.
Of being Jew.
Right.
So now, if so, your genealogical—you can't do anything about your genealogical heritage, mm-hmm. whoever you are.
Yeah, that's a given.
You can have something to do with your Jewish affiliation as far as God goes. So I could be considered, because I accept the Old Testament, mm-hmm. that I am a Jewish Christian, mm-hmm. right?
Well, you'd have to be, in this language, you have to be Torah observant. And most Christians today would follow Paul and say that we've been freed from some aspects of the law, particularly the ceremonial. The ethical, moral, we're not freed from, kind of thing. But we're freed from that. And that, I know in the Protestant tradition, we actually have a statement that says that. Of all things ceremonial, the law of the Old Testament does not apply to us. To all things moral. So there's a continuity and discontinuity. I think for Paul, Paul's big, and we'll end with this. Here's Paul's big deal. Paul thinks the covenant that God made with Israel through Abraham and Moses is still valid. The Jews have not been real faithful to it, and they misunderstood it, but it's still valid. Now God has done a new thing. God has made a new covenant through Jesus. And God's bringing in all these new people. Doesn't mean he's gotten rid of the Jews. Jews and Jesus followers are now together. And in Romans, he calls them Israel. And Israel for Paul simply means God's people. So Paul's part of that new adventure that God's doing a new thing, bringing those in. And we'll have a lot of time to revisit all these, because we have playing this out for a while.